This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
March Madness is here, and if you want to enhance the experience, join me, Gary Parrish, and my colleague Matt Norlander on the Ion College Basketball Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. We have new episodes at least three times a week and at the end of every night of the NCAA tournament. So before you go to bed, hang with us or know we'll be there when you awake. We'll break down games, make picks against the spread. Most of all, we'll have a blast. So join us on the Ion College Basketball Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast.
6:14 on this Tuesday morning. Got some spotty fog around. Be aware of that. Highs today of 79 degrees going up to 80. And it was warm yesterday afternoon after the rain went through. 81 tomorrow. 79 Thursday. Chance for showers Friday. And then a 90% chance for rain on Saturday, which is really awful for the Irish Channel St. Patrick's Day parade because that was their makeup day to parade after they were rained out the first time. Then Sunday, more parades planned. Nice then, highs of 84. In Gretna, I think they got a big parade. So that's pretty warm, mid-80s. And before you know it, man, the heat and humidity of summer will be here. So get out and enjoy whatever spring weather is left while you can. Mark Hamrick joins us now, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. Stagflation hits. It's going to be hard to enjoy anything because I know I lived through it as a very, very young person, as did a lot of y'all listening. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Doing well, sir. Good to be with you. Good morning.
Did you live through, I'm not trying to pry into your personal business here or anything, but did you live through stagflation in the 70s?
Yes, very much so. I was a teenager and older by that time.
There is a great shot, an old TV program, The Rockford Files, where in the opening credits he's buying a steak and he's got his eyes rolled, putting it in the basket like he has no choice. And I always hearken to that because that, Mark, seems to me to sum the entire thing up where it's like, well, I guess I got to buy it. I don't know what else to do. Tell people what stagflation is for those that were not around for it.
Well, this is a term that gets bandied about quite a bit, and knowing that we were going to discuss this, I was curious to see what a literal dictionary, a definition of it looks like. And it's consistent, I think, with the definition that a lot of people associate, and that is persistent high inflation combined with high unemployment and stagnant demand in a country's economy. It was used most often during the time span that you talked about, but the use of the word actually has continued quite commonly through, I would say, the last couple of decades. So it's very much a term that is worth knowing about and, as you indicate, pondering whether it could be increasingly relevant.
I would also ask those that were not there to be around for to Google Jimmy Carter and General Milley's speech, because it was astounding to have the President of the United States come on and say that the country was in a general malaise. Let's talk about the economy in the United States now, and what are the conditions that could lead to stagflation, another round of it, or what is it that has investors concerned, Mark?
Yeah, this question was asked of Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell maybe a few news conferences ago, meaning perhaps in the middle part of last year. And he obviously is in his 70s now as well. And so he was alive when the period occurred that you're talking about. And people who weren't conscious at that time would be well to remember that essentially what happened was the Arab oil embargo, and we had gasoline lines and very high interest rates resulted from the high inflation, and eventually by creating a recession or two, Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker was able to slay the beast that was high inflation, but it took a lot of pain. And so we're in a much different situation right now, to the extent that we're complaining about inflation that's roughly at a 2.5% level, not in the high single digits or even low double digits, and in some cases high double digits. Doesn't mean it's any more pleasant to deal with. And, you know, it's the primary complaint that people have about the economy is elevated prices, which result from inflation. I think you'd have to get a substantial rise in the unemployment rate, which right now is at 4.1%, a substantial rise, you know, something that's more akin to what we see during recessions. When we had a recession before the COVID crisis, the previous recession had produced unemployment of 10% in 2009, and so 4.1% that we have right now is far from that. And of course, we were 14.8% in early 2020, but that persisted, thankfully, for only about a month or so. So we'd have to have much higher unemployment, and I think that we'd have to have higher inflation as well. And, you know, crossing our fingers, right now I don't think that that is a realistic concern. In other words, something to be aware of, you know, and I would always say, well, what should we do about it? Save more money, have more money in emergency savings, et cetera, pay down debt are really two time-tested smart things to do. But recession risks are clearly rising, and so, you know, that in and of itself is concerning enough.
Let's talk about the stock market when we come back. 401ks, I don't know if it's up or down. Not 401ks specifically, because that would depend on what you're invested in, but I don't know if the market's rallying or not. Sometimes people breathlessly tell you what's going on after 3 minutes of trading when the market opens, and that seems to me a little premature. Somebody texted in, I guess you Democrats can dream and hope. Somebody else texted in and said, no pain, no gain. But I think you have to... I guess you have to wonder if stagflation produced any gain, and what was the state of the economy in November and December? What's the state of it today, and are we gaining anything or not? So we'll talk about all that when we come back with Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, who, like me, is neither blue or red, but I think for the most part green and concerned with money. 621 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, about stagflation. Is it coming? Is it something to just keep an eye on, something we could actively worry about? Mark, inevitably, you know, when it comes to all this stuff, we talked about being on Team Red or Team Blue. I don't care about any of that. I'm just concerned. I mean, I care about the country, obviously, and the future and the security of the country. But I also care about how I'm doing with the economy and how my personal financial situation is. That comes first. So when it comes to the state of the economy and Wall Street and tariffs and so forth, do we know how the markets reacted to all of this yet? Because it seems like it's down, it's up, it's down, it's up. But that's what markets do, right?
Over time, obviously, Tommy, the markets move up and down. And people have, in a way, been spoiled by the last few years where we had double-digit percentage rallies in each of the previous 2 years in the S&P 500, which is the main index that's relevant to most people's investments, whether they're saving for retirement through a 401k. And so think about the fact that the S&P 500 has been up sharply in the past 2 years. A pullback would have been expected no matter what. You know, we survey professional investors every quarter, and they told us in the fourth quarter of last year that people should be prepared for the possibility of less than stellar returns in the coming 12 months and perhaps even below normal returns in the next 5 years. But this is a horse of a different color in the era in which we're talking right now because of the high degree of volatility and uncertainty. And uncertainty undermines consumer confidence. It is undermining consumer confidence. It's undermining business confidence. The S&P 500 was down as much as 10% recently from the high. but it's come back. And so year to date, the S&P 500 is down all of 2%. And over the last 3 months, it's down 3.6%. So that's basically, it's not been a garden variety move for this index or the rest of the market, but the fact that it has recovered within this, what was called a correction in the 10% pullback, should give people at least some a sense of relief for now, but I'd be the last person to try to predict what the market's going to do in the intermediate term.
At what point does the market accept uncertainty, if that doesn't sound too dumb, where they realize that, okay, for the next couple of years, it's going to be tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs on, tariffs off. Who knows what the outcome's going to be because President Trump runs things differently than did previous presidents. Does the market eventually adapt to that, Mark?
I don't think so, because that, you know, that is the polar opposite of what businesses and consumers need to be able to look through to make decisions that they need to make. And so if you're a business leader, you know, obviously if you've got customers knocking at your door and you need to crank out more widgets, you're going to do that. But if you're buying aluminum or steel to make those widgets and you're worried that the boat that's already set sail with all of your widgets and steel is going to cost you all of your capital operating budget, you know, for the coming year to just import that steel and pay the tariff, you are worried whether you're going to be able to stay in business. And so this lack of predictability, I think, is as bad as anything that I could possibly come up with short of a recession or war itself. And so we need to have consistency, and we need to have some degree of certainty, and not the maybe we will, maybe we won't, maybe we'll do something halfway, which is sort of the way the news cycle's been going of late.
What can people do, Mark, personally, to protect themselves, insulate themselves from this up and down inconsistency?
I really, you know, like to stick to the notion that best financial practices hold true through thick and thin, through good times and challenging times. And most Americans live paycheck to paycheck. We're a paycheck to paycheck country. So help us break out of that cycle by having 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. It's not going to happen overnight if one's beginning that, but we just need to have a dedicated savings account that comes out of direct deposit and funds itself. And then over time, we'll have enough money to pay for that emergency expense or the unforeseen event.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate your time as always. Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. You really do need to start saving money. And I don't care if it's a piggy bank. I don't care if it's saving it and turning it into big bills and then putting them in the bank. Whatever you got to do, come up with a way to incentivize yourself to save money and spend less. That's the only way. 6:30, more when we come back. Time now, WWL First News. 6:45, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Another nice spring day today. Warmer than it has been, though. Yeah, man, yeah, I was outside yesterday playing with the dog. It was hot to me anyway. Highs today of 79, and then moving ahead tomorrow, 81, 78 on Thursday. I should mention there's a little bit of patchy fog out there. Be aware of that. 40% chance for showers on Friday. Then Saturday, unfortunately, the day, the makeup day for the Irish Channel, St. Patrick's Day Parade, 90% chance for showers then. Clear, not clear, but partly cloudy Sunday with highs in the mid-80s for the Gretna Irish-Italian thing that they got going. Larry Carter joins us now, our friend, President of Louisiana Federation of Teachers. How you doing, Larry?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about Amendment Number 2 and teacher pay raises, because I've heard some different things, and it surprises me in a way to hear that you're asking people to vote for Amendment Number 2. Tell me about it.
Yes, look, it's one of the most important constitutional amendments for us and for probably the community as a whole. What it does for us, and I'm talking about teachers and school employees, it kind of addresses one of the probably most pressing concerns for teachers and school employees, and that's financial stability. The amendment, to be clear, it will convert that one-time stipend into permanent parts of teachers and school employees' pay. It's not a pay raise, and most people have been saying that, and it's not. It's over the last 2 years, teachers and school employees have been getting a $2,000 supplement for teachers and a $1,000 supplemental pay for school employees. It is not a permanent part of their salaries. That means if the budget or the economy tanks quickly, it could be reduced and not added for the following year in 2026. And so what we're saying is this is the only opportunity that's on the table for teachers and school employees to have that stipend, that one-time stipend, converted to a permanent part of their salaries. It is the only instrument that's out there. If you looked at the executive budget that the governor laid out, it is not in his budget. For the last 2 years, there have been, again, supplemental pay of $2,000 and $1,000. And so for us, our members, we polled our members over the last probably 6 months, from probably September till probably we're going to end the survey in at the end of this month. And the number one concern out there was compensation and pay, probably at about, I would say, 89, almost 90% of those who participate in our survey. We then had robust conversations within our executive council about the position that we would take on this. And while we know there are numbers of organizations out there that took the other side of that coin, our members and our executive council decided that, of course, when we're talking about turning a supplemental pay into a permanent pay, it was one of the decisions that we had to come out. While it wasn't the way we usually have funding for teacher and school employee compensation, it was the only opportunity for teachers and school employees to see that stipend turned into a permanent part of their salaries.
Does this, how does this play out with local school districts or where the money's coming from? Somebody texted in, they're confused about who decides who gets what, when, and that's their problem with Amendment Number 2.
Yeah, when you look at Amendment 2, I know there's a lot of objects or a lot of subjects in that particular amendment. But for us, when we look at the part that specifically talks about teacher and school employees' pay, it is governed by what's called Act 8. It was originally House Bill 5 that was part of the legislation that actually is the companion legislation to the Constitution Amendment. In particular, we fought hard and worked directly with Representative Bacala, Senator Edmonds, and the governor to add amendments to ensure that the pay and the supplement was kind of really vetted out and kind of meet sort of the provisions of what would normally be done. We advocated and really got an Act 8 mandatory salary schedule incorporation, meaning that it would become a permanent part of their salaries. We fought for strong non-surplantation protection, meaning that if the district couldn't reduce that any other compensation to offset this increase, we included retirement benefit protection that ensures that any associated retirement costs, they're covered to protect employees' future benefits. There's an accountability mechanism that's in that amendment through that supplemental legislation that supports that by having, if a superintendent decides that he or she is not going to be compliant, they have to go before both the House and Senate Education Committees to explain that. And then there's leave protections that ensures every employee who is on an approved leave still receives the increase and that the funding is guaranteed. And if a district doesn't see the kind of savings that's expected from the pay down of the TRSL, the retirement benefit, is insufficient, additional funding will be provided through the minimum foundation program, the MFP. That's usually how these raises are funded. So we fought really, really hard during the session to make sure that this part of what we thought was going to be a constitutional amendment around teacher pay. But then we see there's a lot of other parts to that that really make it difficult, I know, for some people. But for us, we saw it as an opportunity to make sure that we continue to support teachers and school employees and make sure that we don't lose them to surrounding states and our other professions. So for us, it was, again, one of those tough decisions that we had to make when everyone else seems to be on a different path and a different side to the coin of making that decision on Amendment 2. We vetted, again, the discussion, and we felt like it was the right thing to do for teachers and school employees.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, 6:51 and a half. Larry Carter, president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers, a lot in Amendment Number 2, but he's saying as it relates to teachers, he thinks that that is the way to go when it comes to making sure that, I guess, the teacher's supplemental stipend is codified and becomes part of a permanent pay raise. We'll pick it up. We come back again. Any questions, comments, especially if you're a teacher, 504-260-1870. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:58, couple of minutes till 7. Larry Carter, our guest, president of Louisiana Federation of Teachers, he says that teacher unions are backing Amendment Number 2. There's a lot in there. I'm getting some text. Some of them are saying that, Larry, that the governor is kind of like forcing the teachers up against the wall, or that they're kind of not using the teachers, but holding them hostage, I guess, to support an amendment that has a lot of other stuff in there just to get a pay raise that's guaranteed and not a stipend. Is this the best of a bad deal? How would you look at this?
Look, I've heard that often, even by some of our members, but I can say this. We are kind of caught, you know, between accepting a complicated constitutional amendment with far-reaching implications, and we face an immediate, you know, reduction in take-home pay if this is the only instrument that's allowed to make a supplemental pay permanent. Look, this is not a straightforward solution, and it's one that, you know, we would, you know, not have preferred, because it's, you know, really done through the MFP. And so it's currently the only path forward to preserve, you know, teacher and school employee compensations, because we don't want to lose them, like I said before, to neighboring states or other professions. And so, yes, we totally understand it's a complicated, complex constitutional amendment. But for us, the decision was to support the amendment because it protected the educators from losing compensation they've come to rely on for the last 2 years.
Thank you, Larry. We'll take a break, talk about slowpokes in the left lane when we come back. 7:15, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Kind of chilly start to the morning, but it's going to warm up rapidly, going up to near 80 today, and it's going to be warm throughout the week. That chance for showers on Saturday, unfortunately. Right now it's 57 degrees and feels a little bit cooler than that outside because it's damp and maybe some patchy fog. We're getting ready to talk to Senator Jay Luno, Louisiana State Senator, obviously, and about a bill that he pre-filed, and we've all been there where you're on the interstate. I know cab drivers are especially guilty of it. Not trying to call you out, but, man, going to the from I-10 heading toward Metairie and Kenner, and they sit in the left lane, they go 50, 55 because they're going to the airport and they're not passing anybody. Then if you get somebody in the right lane or the center lane that's going 50, I've been in backups the entire time that was caused by somebody in the left lane not doing the speed limit or passing anybody. And that's what Senator Luno, who joins us now, wants to fix. How you doing, sir? Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tell me what made you want to file this bill and what the bill says.
So actually, this has been a law in Louisiana for quite some time, and some people don't realize that, but the law is that you use the left lane for passing and not for traveling. The right lane is for the travel lane. Driving up and down the highways of Louisiana from the northern part of my district up in Lincoln Parish all the way down to the southern part of Boyle's Parish and then on to Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. I encountered a lot of folks that apparently didn't understand that was the law in the state of Louisiana. And I've also found out that this activity also causes accidents on our highways that can lead to running up our insurance costs as well. And that's one of the things that we've been working on in the legislature to try to remedy is the high cost of automobile insurance. So that was kind of the genesis of this, and we started from there and got to where we are today.
So it's already illegal to do that, right? And some people are saying, well, why do we need another law? Why don't we enforce the one we have? But you did some digging, and apparently you found out that it's from state police is not as easy to enforce as you would think, the current law?
That's right. The current law is a little bit convoluted in that in some instances it requires a 10-mile-per-hour deviation from the speed limit or the difference in the speed of the vehicles and those kind of things, which made it very difficult for the police to enforce. It also, there was some confusion by some law enforcement agencies about people driving in the left lane when they were on a place on a four-lane highway where they could actually turn left, which is legal. And so we're trying to just kind of simplify this and give the police some discretion in whether they should stop someone who's actually impeding traffic or someone who's just trying to get to the location that they're actually going to.
I don't know how I understand you're an attorney. Are you not, sir?
I am.
So I don't understand how you enforce this, because who's to say that I'm passing somebody? And look, I'm all with you. There's nothing that drives me crazy. I don't know if you heard me say that before I brought you on about cab drivers from heading from New Orleans into the airport, just tying up the left lane, and then you get somebody on side of them, and the entire interstate is backed up because somebody's not doing what they're supposed to do. But how do you determine who's passing at a slower rate, passing somebody slower than them in a left lane, right? If somebody in the middle lane's going 45, for example, and then somebody's going 55 passing them, but then somebody's going 65 behind them, it would appear as though they're impeding traffic. And I'm not trying to get this, make this incredibly complicated. I'm just trying to figure out the law enforcement standpoint, how you go about enforcing the law.
So one of the things that I found was this law is rarely enforced. There are very few tickets that are written for violation of this law, fewer than almost any other that deals with moving violations. And one of the reasons was because the police officers really just didn't feel like they had the ability to make the determination of whether or not the person was truly impeding traffic and how they would go about proving that if they had to in a court. So what we're looking for is citations to be written to the most flagrant violators, people who insist on driving in the left lane when it's obvious that they're blocking traffic, people who drive side by side with another vehicle for miles at a time and with long lines of traffic behind them. We're not making it where we're reinventing the wheel. We're just trying to simplify it somewhat so we can stop some of this. One of the things that I've noticed over the years is that people with out-of-state license plates, when you drive up behind them on the interstate or the highways in Louisiana, they tend to move over. If they don't see you coming, then they see you coming. They tend to move over.
Yep.
And so we were hoping we're going to get some of that. And, look, that's one of the reasons what we did with the fines on this. The fine originally, I think, was a $100 fine. If you were found guilty of this, I've increased that to $150 for the first offense, $250 for a second offense that occurs within 12 months of the first one, and then $350 for an offense that occurs within another 12 months, plus the possibility of up to 30 days in jail if you're a flagrant violator.
I've driven up to your area, beautiful area of the state. I got a kid that lives up north and went to Northwestern State, so I went up the traditional way through, I guess, Baton Rouge and Lafayette and also 190, and then now I go through Vicksburg to get up to Ruston. And it is a massive problem, and I'm all with you. I just don't know how you enforce this or how you maybe it's education. I don't know. We'll talk more when we come back. Talking to Jay Luna, Louisiana State Senator, and as we talk about this, somebody passed him on, and they were in a left lane. Somebody passed him in the middle lane and flipped him the bird and then got in front of him and went like 55, 60 miles an hour. And so I don't know. Somebody just doesn't want anybody. Sometimes people don't want anybody in front of them. And to be fair, there are others that think they are passing everybody and that the left lane is the Autobahn and they go 120, 140, and you can't have that either. However, going to the senator's point, I do know that having seen it a lot where you got somebody in the left lane that just won't pull over, then they're forced to pass them on the right side, which is not safe. So we'll pick it up when we come back, 721. If you got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Senator Jay Luno. That name just sounds so familiar, Jay. That's why I keep stumbling over it. Were you in a car business at some point, or your family?
No, never been in the car business.
Huh.
Been in a lot of other businesses, but not that one.
Maybe I knew somebody named Jay Luno at one point. Anyway, talking about slow pokes in the left lane, do you think it might have something to do with education? Because I always wonder, do the people not know any better? Like you mentioned, so the out-of-state. Go ahead.
I think it does in some instances. The other thing, I think it's a mindset. I talked to a gentleman one time, and we were talking about the subject. He was an older friend of mine, a very conservative person, and he told me, he said, I'm a tax-paying citizen of the state of Louisiana, and if I want to drive in the left lane, I'll drive in the left lane. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to change that kind of mindset. You know, I've seen so many times, I noticed you had the president of Farm Bureau on a commercial just moments ago, and during sugarcane season, when those trucks are on the road, they drive mm-hmm. slower, and a lot of times people will get up beside them, and they'll cause a traffic jam. Now, not only does that make it a dangerous situation because it causes road rage and people passing unsafely, sometimes even on the shoulder so they can get around these these jams, but you're impeding other people that have places to be on a timely manner. The people that are trying to get their kids to school on time, the people that are trying to get to work on time, and not to mention the freight that's being moved across the highways in Louisiana. We have, you know, more ports than almost any state, and we have a lot of truck traffic, and it impedes that traffic and makes it dangerous as well.
And these trucks can't start and stop on a dime, and I've seen people in the right lane that do try to pass in the left lane, but they don't want to take it off of cruise control, so they want to pass somebody going 60 in the left lane. They're in the middle lane. They want to keep the cruise control at 60 and pass somebody. And I think people also need to realize, Senator, that if you're going to pass somebody, pass them. You can't just keep the cruise control set, right?
That's correct. And you know, there's so many issues that you see, and when you get to multiple lane roads, when you get out of four lane roads and you get to six and eight, it just compounds the problems when you see people doing this. So we're trying to bring some attention to it. It's not going to be a perfect fix. Rarely is legislation a perfect fix. Sometimes it takes some amendments, some tweaking to get it right. But we're trying to start here to make some change for the good.
I got to bring up insurance rates because, you know, I was saying earlier, Senator, when I work out, I watch Sanford and Son because I like to laugh, right, and get away from reality. And I was watching an episode from 1973, and he was talking about whiplash rhyming with get cash, and that was back in the 70s. It seems as though that has become an industry in Louisiana with the attorneys just talking about how they won this much for their client and that much. You get hit by a truck with a sign on it, don't do anything, call me. Is there anything that can be done to address that, and what role does that play? Soft tissue damage is what Jim Donlin used to say about lawsuit abuse when it comes to auto rates and maybe bringing us at least down to Texas or Mississippi numbers.
So the fact of the matter is that we have been working on that for quite some time now. We've been having, since last session last year, we've been having numerous meetings throughout to try to address that. The only thing that we've really done in the past 40 years to try to address this is what's known as tort reform. Mm-hmm. Tort reform is nothing more than taking rights away from people who have been injured to about how they go about recovering for their damages. That has not worked. It's been an abysmal failure. It's proven in not only in Louisiana, but other states. And in fact, the insurance industry, many CEOs will tell you, tort reform doesn't lower insurance rates. But one of the things that we have recently found out is that we've been hearing for years, 10 years I've been in the Senate, that insurance companies in Louisiana are losing money. They're not making money. Well, that's not correct. We use their own information from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to find out they're making a lot of money in Louisiana. And look, there's nothing wrong with that. Every business needs to be profitable. We need those businesses here in Louisiana. We need them to be profitable. But insurance needs to be regulated more because it's mandatory that we buy it. As citizens of Louisiana,
let me run this by you real quick.
We have to buy it.
We only have a minute left. I'm going to tell Dave Cohen we're going to be a minute late on news here. Sorry, Dave. But real quick, 30-40 second response, Senator. Is there any way, would there be any way to tie it into, okay, you want to charge high insurance rates, that's fine, but you either have to write home insurance, homeowners insurance, or cut the rates on that. It's like, okay, so you want to milk people on the auto rates, that's fine. You're making a lot of money, but you're going to have to make up for it on the homeowner side. Any way to link that?
You know, it's a difficult situation. We've seen in Florida the problems they have where they had some companies that came in at writing multiple lines, and some of these companies were taking money out of the state of Florida and sending it to affiliate companies, and they ended up insolvent or bankrupt. And so it creates a whole other set of issues. But that is one of the things we can look at. Look, we're going to see lots of bills coming up, not just tort reform, but a lot of regulatory-type bills and things like that coming up in the legislature this year that hopefully – we're going to be able to get a handle on this and start bringing some of these rates down.
Thank you, Senator. We'll talk to you again during the session. Got to go. Dave Cohen here, WWL First News. 744, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend, Louisiana State Senator Pat Connick. How you doing, Pat?
Hey, I'm doing great, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Before we do anything else, we got to talk about what's happening on Saturday, March 29th, coming up.
Yeah, the 23rd Annual Louisiana Crawfish Bowling Championships at Immaculate Conception School in Marrero. We got 50 teams again this year, plus it's going to be a great, great time again. We're looking forward to having you as a judge.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being there, although I feel like sometimes to me, I just think they're good or they're bad. And then you got people like Ian McNulty that are there that are these, what do you call them, aficionados or experts that, well, a little bit too much garlic, a little bit too much this, a little bit too much that. And I'm just thinking, well, it's good, give me more. Let's talk about imported seafood and the crawfish festival in Chalmette and Chinese crawfish and not the proper signage. What does the law say now? Pat, I know there's been something you've been passionate about, you've been involved with. What can be done and can Louisiana provide enough seafood, or can America provide enough seafood for the country? Is that what it's about, or is it just about letting people know what they're eating? Take me through all of this, please.
I think the key to that legislation is letting people know, giving them the option of buying foreign seafood or local seafood. It's labeling packages that says, you know, product of China, product of Indonesia, or product of the Louisiana, Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of America, whatever you want to call it. But it's just not being deceived, having a consumer not being deceived by thinking they're buying a Cajun, you know, Louisiana brand product when it's coming from China. And that's what the law that we passed says, and we have some penalties that are coming in place. But some stores are abiding by it, some are not, and we have to have some enforcement come in and you know, make them follow the rules.
How hard is it for people that are in a crawfish business to know where the crawfish are coming from, or is it that hard at all?
You know, a lot of crawfish, you know, came from here, but the stuff in the packaging right now, if you look at the back, some of it's very, you know, small print, but you have the Cajun labeling on it. You think it's from Louisiana. You got the state of Louisiana symbol on it, but you're being deceived. We can't prevent foreign seafood from coming in. You know, the courts have ruled on that, but we can make those who import and those who sell it and package it declare where it's coming from. So the consumer has a choice of saying, okay, I want the cheaper product from China, or I want the good stuff coming from Broad Bridge.
Let's talk about Amendment Number 2. The ballot, early voting, I think, is done, and then we got the election on March 29th, the day of the crawfish championship. So vote and then go eat your crawfish. Tell me about lost my train of thought here for a second, Pat. I'm sorry. About the
Amendment 2,
yes. I'm sorry. About the reasons you think people should vote for it.
Tell me, I've been in Baton Rouge for about 17 years now. I think this is one of the most important pieces of legislation from a tax standpoint that we have passed since I've been up there. This is going to change the business climate in the state. It's going to make Louisiana more competitive. It's going to take away the old Huey Long laws, way of doing business, getting out of our system. It's going to hopefully make Louisiana more competitive, attract manufacturing jobs, and keep our families in Louisiana, and give those who left a reason to come back. You know, I think it's that important. We need to change the way we do business in the state, and this Amendment Number 2, I think, is the way to go to make that happen.
What would you say to people that say it's too much too fast, that there might be some unintended consequences in there, et cetera?
You know what? This is a long time coming. It's not fast enough for me. You know, I heard, you know, we passed this in 2 weeks, but that's not, you know, we did pass it, but we worked on it for over a year, making it, trying to please everybody and make Louisiana more competitive. It's going to reduce lower the state income tax to a flat 3%. It's going to raise teacher and support staff pay. And then we're going to pay down $2 billion in debt, and we're going to be saving $300 million in interest payments every year. It's like paying your house note off. And then that interest payment, instead of going to the bank, will go to allow us to build roads, give teachers raises, do the things we need to do. And it's going to protect the homestead exemption and double the exemption for seniors from $12,500 to $25,000. I think it's a great, great piece of legislation that can, you know, really do good things for the state.
Right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. That means a lot coming from you, Senator Pat Conniff, endorsing Amendment Number 2. We'll talk about DOTD when we come back and more. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Time now for traffic on WWL. 56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend and fellow Shaw graduate, Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator, about Amendment Number 2. Pat, somebody texted in and said it doesn't give teachers raises, he's lying, et cetera, et cetera. Larry Carter was on with us earlier at 6:45, President of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. He says he's firmly behind this Amendment Number 2, and he thinks if you want a permanent teacher pay raise, you should... he's urging people to vote for this, and he's the president of the Louisiana Federation of Teachers. Thoughts on people that are... Go ahead.
If I put $2,000 in your pocket that you didn't have every year from here on out, that's a pay raise to me. So you can say how whatever you want, but I think the money going to the teachers is what's taking place, and that's going to help the teachers, and that's the reason why I support this bill.
Tell me why you think and why you're so behind this and why you think it's going to change things business-wise in Louisiana and be a good thing for the state, Pat.
I think what we're doing in the past is not working. We're being, you know, Mississippi is getting manufacturing jobs, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas. This is a way to start competing with those states, and that's why it's so important to me and so important to everybody else that we get this done. We have to stop the old ways of doing business, and this is, I think, is a step in a major step in the right direction. That's why I'm passionate about it.
So along those lines, what happens if it doesn't pass?
We're going to try it again. You know, we're going to keep pushing. We're not going to give up because that's so important to the state and to our future, you know, our grandkids and kids and families.
Somebody texted about seafood. Why not just make it illegal to sell foreign seafood in Louisiana? Can that be done, or is that federal?
That's federal. It's unconstitutional. You know, the Commerce Clause prevents that. You know, we can import, you know, what we need to import. But the whole thing is this is not being deceived by a product from China being packaged as a product from Louisiana.
Somebody else texted and said, you want to make America great again, buy American products, buy American seafood, buy Louisiana seafood, and don't buy the imports. And I think... sometimes you got to let your wallet back up what your mouth says sometimes and be serious and committed to what it is that you want to be committed to. Tell me about DOTD. I'll bring up the Bell Chase Bridge and what the long-range plans are for that. The other crossing at, I'm trying to think of down the road there. I can't think of the name of it right now, Pat.
The Peters Road Bypass. You
know, yeah, Peters Road Bypass.
Seconds. Plaquemines Parish has so much potential. They have those plants being built, billion-dollar plants, but there's no way to get in to, you know, to and from them. We need a second bridge in Bell Chase, the Peters Road Bridge that's going to go along the Harvard Canal. We've been working with Jacob Bro, who's a hell of a state rep for that area, and pushing hard to get some funding and get that project underway and moving. You know, Plaquemines has given a lot to the state. We got to get back to them. So,
does expansion that expansion on the LNG plant, does that change the equation at all? Where it's like even more revenue for the state, more jobs, more money, et cetera.
Absolutely, it's going to bring more jobs, but it's going to be more construction jobs and put more traffic burden on Plaquemines Parish. And they have one way in and one way out, basically for that parish, and it's a toll road, and I think it's so unfair for that to take place, but that was done, you know, way in the past, but we got to try to find a way to mitigate those losses.
Thank you, Pat. Appreciate your time. See you Saturday. Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator. He'll be at the Big Crawfish Cook-Off March 29th at Our Lady of... Tell me, Pat. I forgot the... Pat, you there? He hung up. I'll tell you about the details when we come back. I got a lot in front of me right now, but we'll get it together. Back in a flash, WWL. 8:15, now some patchy fog about. Be aware of that. 58 degrees. Feeling a little bit cooler than that to me, maybe because of the humidity. I don't know. Highs today of 79, 81 tomorrow, 78 on Thursday. A chance for showers Friday afternoon, 76 for a high. 90% chance for rain on Saturday, but the Crawfish Boil Championships go on. Rain or shine, and we'll see what happens with the Irish Channel St. Patrick's Day Parade. High Sunday of 84, and we're getting into... April, and that means it's going to start turning hot and humid. Vicki Salemi joins us now, career expert for Monster. How are you, Vicki? Vicki?
Yes, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well, thank you. So here we are some years after COVID, and it seems like the whole world was turned upside down, topsy-turvy. Are we anywhere back to where we were before COVID in terms of employer, employee, and balance of power or supply and demand?
No, the pendulum keeps on moving. So it's an exciting space to be in terms of the supply and demand. You know, companies are still hiring and there's still conversations about working remotely versus back in the office and flexibility with hours. And what we've seen consistently through the constant change with Monster, we're seeing a lot of demand for flexibility. So that has not changed. That continues to be top of mind and a hot topic.
When you say flexibility, you mean as far as hours or working from home or what?
All of the above, Tommy. It's really, you know, people think about working from home or hybrid situation, but also when they work. If they're back in the office, maybe it's more flexible hours, four-day work weeks, variations on it.
We know that there have been some things in the news lately about going back to the office and so forth. What is the trend among the leading companies or in the job market overall? Because I can make a case for both ways. I could see where maybe people would be more productive after COVID, and employers realize that. But employers also realize that, you know what, we're saving a lot of money by not maintaining these offices, or at least supplying these offices or having as big of an office. So there's a case to be made on both sides. How's it playing out in the real world?
Both ways, actually. It depends on the company as well as the industry, as well as if the company has, say, an expensive lease that they have empty offices and they're paying for that lease, and they feel also that productivity is key in the office. But no, I think the sweet spot is for companies and workers to see where they are most productive, and that might be a combination, like going into the office for valuable meetings, but also realizing maybe this doesn't need to be a meeting. Maybe this can be a five-minute call or an email exchange to really value everyone's time to see what is most effective. And it's helpful for job seekers, too, so they know if they don't enjoy or they don't thrive in their current situation, that other companies, there are options at other companies.
Where are the jobs now, Vicki?
You know, in terms of industry, among the top jobs every month, I get a list from Monster with the top 10 most frequent jobs, most in demand, and I've seen them in healthcare. It consistently comes up, such as physical therapist, nurse, registered nurse. There are other jobs in terms of truck drivers. There's a demand for that, and office managers, business managers. So in a variety of different industries, so if I was a job seeker, I would look at these job descriptions in terms of what the requirements are and work backwards to see where are your current skills, where do you need to be, and how you can get those skills and experiences to land those jobs.
One question I get from people constantly on text line whenever you come on and consistently is, how do I forecast for my child who is now 10 or 15 where the jobs are going to be 10, 15 years from now, what they should study, what they should major in, what they should go into, what does the future portend?
It's such an interesting topic, Tommy, because so much has changed. I mean, we were having this conversation 10, even, gosh, 20 years ago, social media wouldn't come up. So things keep changing. So I think the number one thing is to be nimble. And also number two is for their child to have them explore different interests, because you don't want to just pursue a job, let's say, or a path because it's in demand. If you, let's say, faint at the sight of blood, you're not going to be the best nurse and you won't enjoy it either. So it's, you know, it's important to also develop valuable soft skills that you can get in any job. And that's, you know, having a strong work ethic. I know you and I have talked about this a while when we talk about different differences in the various generations. You know, it's a work ethic. Empathy, listening, problem-solving skills, communication skills. So I would focus on them developing those vital skills in addition to the technical aspects of various industries and jobs.
When it comes to, well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're talking to Vicki Salemi, career expert from Monster. Apparently, there's the bump that was there for people hopping from job to job is disappearing. So we'll talk about that, about lateral moves, et cetera. Is it better to move or sticking with your current company? And also about the trend of, you know, it's cliche now to say it's not like it used to be in terms of pensions and people staying with one company, but how long is too long to stay with a company, and is it important to be mobile now as a young person manages their career, or do they want to try to build up some tenure? 821 Traffic, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Vicky Salemi, our friend, the career expert for Monster, about a Wall Street Journal story saying that the bump that people were experiencing post-COVID for skipping or moving around from jobs to jobs has kind of disappeared or leveled out. Vicky, you know, back in the day, people would say that if people move from job to job, that they had a problem, and that well, why were you moving constantly? Why did you stay with this person for that long? But it seems as though the script may have been flipped, and now if you stay with a company for so long, maybe the future employers are saying, well, why were you there so long? Why didn't you move around? Has the whole thing changed?
It has changed, Tommy, and I'm so glad that we're talking about this. There used to be a stigma around phone calls. Job hopping. When I was in recruiting for years, if anyone on their resume had a job or an employer for less than 2 years, it was a red flag. It was like, okay, they are a flight risk. Now, the opposite is true. And I'm not saying that it's okay to job hop every 6 months consistently, but if you do stay with a company, let's say 10, 15, 20 years, there can be somewhat of a stigma with that because employers may assume that you don't have the ability to learn new skills, you may be stagnant. Again, it's all assumptions, but they would prefer you having, let's say, three employers over 15 years rather than one.
When it comes to moving from job to job, does it matter if you move up with the same company?
Usually, I mean, does it matter to the employer when they're looking at your resume?
Right, right. In the future, like, okay, I was with the same company for 15 years, but I did move up 5 times. So in essence, I moved, just not with different companies.
Yeah, that's important because you can show growth with that as well as new skills and staying relevant compared to, let's say, if you had lateral moves or the same job the entire time. And I do want to talk about lateral moves. Let's say if you are with the same company, but you go to another company and then that's on your resume, that's not a red flag because you may look for a new job for a variety of reasons. And that lateral move to another company may position you better for an upward trajectory, new skill set, et cetera.
So when it comes to negotiating power and moving jobs, has the power shifted from employer to employee? Whose market
is
it?
Yeah, it keeps going. It's slightly back and forth. And I should say employers are still hiring and there's still a talent shortage. But 50% of workers from Monster Data say it's harder to look for or find a job as companies cut costs, because they're one of the main reasons why people usually leave to get a new job elsewhere is to earn more money. And their expectations are right now 95% of workers said their current wages have not kept up with the rising cost of living. This is also Monster Data. So if they're driven to get another job externally, they're trying to negotiate, the employer may say, we just don't have that type of increase. It might be a 3% or 5% increase from what you're earning now. So even though job seekers have power in negotiating, their expectations may not meet what the reality is.
Somebody texted in that they've been looking for a job, a new job. They're currently employed, but it seems as though companies now are offering big titles, but not necessarily more money. Thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that. So it's important for that person to leverage that title and tap into what the company provides. Let's say internal training, resources. How can that worker bolster their skill sets, learn something new so they can be more marketable elsewhere, and then also talk to their boss at some point throughout the year and say, you know, hopefully I can get a pay increase. What does that look like? What's the timing?
Thank you, Vicky. A pleasure as always. Vicky Salemi, career expert for Monster. We'll take a break. Speaking of jobs, we'll talk with Susan Bourgeois, Louisiana Economic Development Secretary, about the announcement yesterday about Hyundai investing $5.8 billion for a steel facility in Ascension Parish. 8:30 time now, WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL on this Tuesday morning. Good news yesterday for Louisiana about Hyundai and a big steel mill in Louisiana. And here to talk all about it, Susan Bourgeois, Louisiana Economic Development Secretary. Good morning, Madam Secretary. How are you?
I'm well, Tommy. Thanks for having me this morning.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me the genesis. Well, I guess let's start with what exactly was announced for people that missed it, and then we'll go back and talk about the genesis of it.
Sure. So what we announced yesterday at the White House, which was a whole new level of announcements for Louisiana.
Mm. Were you there or not?
I was, yes. Oh, I did. I was able to go. Yeah, it was. Yes.
A thrill,
it really,
huh?
It was a thrill for me, certainly personally, but I do mean this. I think it was as big of a thrill, if not bigger, for our whole team and for Louisiana. The fact that Louisiana was on a world stage announcing something like this, you know, it's changing the narrative, which I keep talking about the importance of us at Louisiana Economic Development and really all of Louisiana changing the narrative about the opportunity. And so when you have the president talking about an announcement on this scale, you are changing the narrative in a way that's not local, that's not national. In fact, it's international. So what we did announce, Tommy, was a Hyundai Motor Group, Hyundai Steel Company, which is a subsidiary of Hyundai Motor Groups, which is all Hyundai and Kia and Genesis vehicles, is going to build and operate a steel plant on the Mississippi River in Donaldsonville, the west bank of Ascension Parish, about a $6 billion capital investment. But as importantly as that to me, Tommy, is that the long-term commitment to jobs. This is a massive jobs opportunity. It's about 1,500 permanent jobs at the facility and 4,000 to 5,000 construction jobs while they build. So just, you know, again, it's our mission at LED to be building opportunity for prosperity and wealth creation for the people of Louisiana, and it's just another example of the win we've had in that space.
Something like this, you know, I always make the example, Susan, of if you go to a PTA meeting, the chairs don't set themselves up, right? And that's the simplest example I can give of stuff just doesn't happen. Take me to the genesis of this. When did the idea first start? The teamwork that was involved, et cetera. How do you go about even beginning to get Hyundai to invest $5.8 billion in a Louisiana steel mill?
Yeah, so, you know, every project is different. And I will say this one was highly competitive, highly complicated. You know, the company works with consultants is oftentimes the way this process will happen. The company, particularly one, an international company that doesn't have as much of a domestic presence from a corporate perspective, they hired consultants. And those consultants, and this is the part that I really want people in Louisiana to hear, they started out with 70 potential locations for this project, 70. About 15 months ago is when we started this process. And we went through proposal after proposal, and every time a question or a concern or a challenge arose.
Wait, tell me again, Susan, I missed that part. How far? What?
15 months ago. And we have been working this project.
Wait, it came together that quickly? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but 15 months this thing came together or not?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. The RFP, you know, again, I don't want to do too much inside baseball speak, but the request for proposals from the consulting company, which basically says, provide us all the opportunities you would have for this kind of acreage, this kind of site, this kind of workforce. And we responded about 14 or 15 months ago. And that's when it began. And this was highly competitive. There were sites all over the South. We don't know exactly where they were, but there were sites certainly all over the South, Texas, Alabama, other places. And we competed. And Louisiana competed aggressively to not just show the infrastructure and the ability we would have to perform the way the company would want us to, but we also competed in just the philosophy of this administration about making Louisiana a business-friendly place where it's easy for people to come here and succeed, because when they succeed, we succeed. And all those things have become real palpable to the company, and ultimately we ended up winning this project. So groundbreaking next year, 1,500 jobs thereafter, and really remarkable transformational project for Ascension, for the West Bank of Ascension. We couldn't be happier.
One thing that I did get text about, people wondering how set in stone is this, how committed is Hyundai to this, and is this going to turn out to be everything that they're saying it's going to be? Hyundai, I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think you saw, I think when you announced something in the West Wing with the president making the announcement and the chairman of the company alongside him, it's pretty serious. I mean, we are formally down this process. I will say that. You know, we have every – this is going to happen. You know, this isn't a hypothetical we might get this Hyundai steel mill. This is going to happen. The company has invested tremendous resources in getting to the point to make this decision. The state has, our partners, and gosh, Tommy, when I tell you the partners involved in this and sort of this whole of Louisiana approach that we have taken to economic development, from our local economic development partners to the, you know, the private sector, you know, these folks came in, they brought in engineers. They didn't understand the Louisiana soil real well, right? So mm-hmm. they wanted to have confidence that frankly the banks of the Mississippi River could support a steel mill. Right. And so the Louisiana engineers, the Louisiana piling companies, the amount of people who have been in the process helping us do their due diligence and the testing. This was a whole of Louisiana approach again and a really heavy lift. And we got it.
So the I's are dotted, T's are crossed. The signatures are on the lines that are dotted.
That's correct.
Good. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up and talk about when we come back about building on this, because this is a huge deal, man. This is great. 851, 9 till 9. You got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Traffic now, WWL. 57 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Susan Bourgeois, Louisiana Economic Development Secretary. Somebody texted in, Susan. I think it's a fair text about film tax industry. Film industry always in the spotlight when it comes to tax credits. How do we know this is a good deal for the state and that we're not giving up more than we're getting? And I will piggyback on that with, it is an extremely competitive environment when it comes to attracting business. And I will ask you, what did the state have to give up, and how do we know, bottom line, on the back end, this is a good deal for the taxpayers?
Are we talking about the steel mill, Tommy, still? Or
yes.
Are you talking about different incentives?
No, they talked about film credits. I'm just saying, I think it's a fair question. So go ahead.
Sure. So, Two important elements to the deal, if you will. Number one is the state is making a pretty significant investment up front to get this project, but the investment is in infrastructure in Louisiana. As you can imagine, a project of this size needs rail, right? It needs roads. It needs docks, right? It needs all the physical infrastructure to be able to support a steel plant. So the biggest portion of our investment is going into roads, docks, rail, and training, by the way. A $30 million campus for the West Bank of River Parish's Community College, which is going to be critical for that community in the long run, right? The training center to be able to train those 1,500 employees and put them to work. And so most of Louisiana's investment in this space is specifically into Louisiana infrastructure that makes the project possible. You know, there's another piece that this is always a tool in any economic development project, but it's called performance-based grants. And so if the company delivers on what it says it's going to do, then the company will get grants to pay them back for additional investment they're making in the state. So it balances their performance and how much money they spend on infrastructure in the state, and we give them money back towards that after they do it.
So can you tell me what's next?
I'm sorry?
The next project? I'm just kidding. I know you're working on something. We'll talk to you again soon.
I'll tell you what's next. I can tell you that we do. Look, I.
Hang on one second. Thank you, Dave. Jam-packed 9 o'clock hour. We're going to talk about the 2025 report card on infrastructure for Louisiana. Louisiana got a D+. The last one was released in 2017. We'll see if things are going to be any better this time. We're going to talk with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about the passengers in the car that killed and hit that St. Tammany police officer, also being charged with first-degree murder. We'll break all of that down. And we're going to talk about the security breach with the text messages with a gentleman who's been on with us before from the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy, Javad Ali. And it was interesting to see the response. Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, denying it when they had already confirmed that it was, in fact, confidential information or security information, our attack plans. The president saying that he didn't like Atlantic Magazine and he thought they were going to be out of business. And it just seems to me the easiest thing in the world would be to say we made a mistake, we're going to tighten it up, or we're not going to do that again. But and also to attack the journalists that received the message inadvertently. You know, he was just sitting in a parking lot at the supermarket and got it. So we'll talk about all that. We begin with Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, to talk about this report card. How you doing, Tom? Tom?
Hi, this is Tom Smith. Greetings. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's Tommy Tucker from WWL. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. Let's start with, what is the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE?
Absolutely. American Society of Civil Engineers is a nonprofit organization of 160,000 members, and we've been around for over 170 years, and we advance the public health and safety and welfare by advancing civil engineering, and one of the things we do is build civilization and focus on infrastructure. So we do a report card on America's infrastructure, which I know is the subject of our discussion this morning.
Yeah, build civilization. I love the way you said that. And that's why I admire engineers, because especially civil engineers, well, I shouldn't say that, but nothing just happens, right? There has to be a lot of planning, and the same numbers that were used to build a bridge back in, I guess, the Egyptian times are the same numbers that are used today, right? Except maybe computed a little bit differently.
Yeah, we've come a long way since then, absolutely. But we have, you know, we have a lot of infrastructure now that unfortunately is been designed and built by a prior generation. And so we have failed to operate and maintain it at the level that we need to. And that's one of the things that we do with our report card on America's infrastructure. For the last over 20 years, we've been evaluating the performance of our infrastructure to make sure that the public and lawmakers understand what is the condition, what is the capacity, what kind of future needs do we have, is it resilient, is it safe, is it innovative, and you know, what kind of operation and maintenance needs we have.
So I got a lot of questions. First of all, let's go back to the report card for America's infrastructure. What are you looking at specifically? How are you measuring? How are you choosing what to look at? Is it based on age? Do you have a list? Take me through that.
Sure. Yeah, we have a team of over 50 people that are professional engineers and infrastructure experts that evaluate data. We look at 18 different categories of infrastructure. So, you know, it's obviously the things you initially think about, like roads and bridges, but it's aviation, it's broadband, it's drinking water, hazardous waste, inland waterways. You know, it ranges all the way up to schools and stormwater and transit. And so all these are things that, you know, we rely on for our quality of life and that are the foundation for our economy and make us globally competitive as a nation. So we look at each of those categories. We look at quite a bit of data, and then we have a methodology where we analyze it according to different criteria. So we're looking at what is its capacity, what kind of condition is it in, what are the funding levels associated with it, what is the future need, the operation and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. So we've been doing that with these criteria. We pour over a lot of data. We're engineers, so you know, we love to look at data and analyze how it's performing and making sure that it's ready for the future. And so we've been doing this. So we first started doing it in 1998, and most recently are issuing our 2025 report card today.
Is this primarily about, I'm trying to think if it's about age or if it's about maintenance or if it's about improved materials or techniques that have happened since then, or a little bit of each?
Yeah, it's a little bit of each. You know, when you talk about age, I mean, some infrastructure can perform. We've got, you know, you can find bridges that are, you know, multiple hundreds of years old. Mm-hmm. As long as you maintain it at the right level, you know, the age is not necessarily a factor. And of course, now we're designing our infrastructure oftentimes to be 75 or 100 years out. So we're trying to anticipate, you know, what kind of weather and climate conditions, you know, 100 years from now for our infrastructure's performance. So yes, it's we're looking at all of those things. Safety, we're looking at the funding levels, we're looking what do we anticipate for the future, we're looking at operation and maintenance, capacity. You know, oftentimes you'll find a bridge that was designed, you know, 50, 75 years ago, and its capacity now, it was designed for a capacity that might be half or less of what it's carrying today. So there's a lot of things that we're evaluating to make sure that our infrastructure is in satisfactory condition.
Just on a very micro level, and we're talking with Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE. I'm sure you've seen that acronym somewhere. But on a micro level, as a homeowner, you tend to think that, and as a younger guy, I thought, okay, that's it. Scratch it off the list. It's done. No, it's not done. It constantly has to be maintained. And I think we as a people and sometimes as a nation don't realize that just because you build a bridge or just because you built a highway, that's not it. That it's not going to last forever, and you do have to maintain it. Is that we do we have a problem with the mindset in this country, Tom?
Yeah, that's. I think you have a great example right there. You know, we cut a ribbon and feel like, okay, now it's done, and that's really just the beginning. A lot of the real costs are the operation and maintenance over many, many years, and whether it's a car or a house, as you referenced, or the human body. You've got to make sure that you are maintaining it. You don't want to have to go out and pay for it twice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you fail, as an example with your, you know, a car or our home, if you don't maintain it, you're going to end up paying a lot more on the back end. And studies have shown that. We have, in terms of infrastructure, every dollar you invest today, it's going to save you up to $13 on the back end. So if we're proactive instead of reactive, we're actually going to save taxpayers far more money. And so we won't pay this hidden tax of poorly functioning, inefficient infrastructure.
You know, as I said that, I was in the automotive repair industry for a while I attended the University of Life, as I call it. And that's a tough business because nobody really wants to spend the money. They're no better off than they were perceptually than they were before whatever broke, right? So it's a miserable
exactly.
business to be in. Nobody's happy. And I suddenly realized as we talk here, that's kind of the same thing that's going on with asking the taxpayers for money to maintain this or that or the other thing, and you think, well, wait, why? We got a bridge. What do we need more money for? But you're about to tell us. Tell me about the grades the nation received and what areas need the most improvement.
Absolutely. So overall, the nation received a grade of C. So, you know, that's not something you'd be particularly proud to bring home on a report card. That's, you know, average. That's mediocre. It requires attention. You know, we know that leaves room for improvement. On the plus side, that is an improvement over the 2021 report card, which was a C-. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you also that the 2021 report card was an improvement over the 2017 report card, which was a D+. Mm-hmm. So in 2021, that was the first time we got out of the D range. So D meaning poor or at risk. So we're now in the C range, and that's good. And that's reflective of some investments that have been made in our infrastructure. You know, we've got the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act. Those things have provided federal investment that have been leveraged with state and local investment and private investment. So we're seeing, you know, investment in our infrastructure that is paying off. And these are incremental improvements. You know, that's taking us to a C. Obviously, we would love to be up at least at the B range, if not beyond. But, you know, this is something that we can celebrate as good progress. But I will say on the downside that of those 18 categories, you know, 9 of those are still in the D range. So that means poor at risk. So we certainly have room for improvement.
When it comes to categories, what are the areas that are more neglected than others?
Well, the lowest grades in the report card right now are stormwater and transit. And obviously, those are both important areas. Stormwater, of course, as we're seeing, you know, more extreme weather events, flooding events. That has certainly, you know about stormwater in New Orleans and of course, throughout the country. So those are particularly areas of concern, and that's a level D. So we have more, you know, impaired rivers, streams, you know, have gone from 424,000 miles impaired streams in 2010. That's gone up to over 700,000 miles in 2022. So that is an area that we think certainly needs attention. Transit is another one that's at a D. Now, the good side about transit is it used to be at a D-. So we actually saw some improvement in transit. But it's got, you know, years of deferred maintenance. Again, like you were describing with cars, we have that same issue with transit and other elements of infrastructure.
Tell me about a new category for the 2025 report card.
Yeah, the new category was broadband. Mm-hmm. That got a grade of a C+, so it's a little bit better than the average grade for all of our other infrastructure. There are certainly areas on broadband that are, again, leave room for improvement. But we this is the first time we've really been able to have a grade in that area because initially we had concerns about even having the amount of data that we needed to give it a grade. So we were able to give it a grade this year. We were pleased about that. So we're going to be able to track our progress on broadband in the future. But, you know, we still have 10% of our households without, you know, a broadband subscription.
Yeah, I was going to say that speaks volumes to what you're talking about here, because you're talking about upgrading or maintaining broadband, and there are areas that still don't have it. So while some people think, well, that's it, that's behind us, it's not, because it constantly has to be maintained. Accurate?
Exactly. Yep. It's just like everything. It's got to be maintained.
Else, yep.
And, you know, a lot of times, you know, when we cut a ribbon and it's all of a sudden after that, it's some of it also, by the way, is out of sight, out of mind. And it has to be operated and maintained at a high level. And that does require consistent and sustained investment. And we also have to really be thinking about, you know, the future, you know, where the puck is going and not just where it has been in the past. And a lot of our infrastructure was designed by a prior generation. It's 50, 75, even 100 years old or more. And so we've got to be sure to maintain it. And also, you know, sometimes we do have infrastructure that needs to be replaced.
I don't know how you sleep at night because, you know, as a homeowner that has done some repairs, once you open the walls up and you get involved with what can break back there or what can go wrong, it's hard to just see a house. You see what's behind the walls and you worry about what can break or what could go wrong. How do you live your life? You got to be looking at everything around you like that, huh, Tom?
Well, that's true. I mean, that's why the inspections are important in maintaining data, sensors, and we do analyze, you know, a lot of data as we're looking at our infrastructure, but also inspecting it on a regular basis. So it's something that has got to constantly be maintained. We need to make sure that we're continuing to draw attention to it, both with the public and with lawmakers. Again, when we fail to invest in infrastructure, we pay more on the back end. Every American family, you know, if we don't maintain the infrastructure that we have, we'll pay an additional $700, you know, if we don't maintain the bipartisan infrastructure law funding levels. Even with those funding levels, we actually compute a $2,000 hidden tax that we pay by failing to, you know, maintain the infrastructure at the level that we need to. Believe it or not, the number that is required to maintain it is about $3.7 trillion. The gap, that's the investment gap over the next 10 years. The good news is that that is money that comes from not just the federal government, but also from state and local and private sector. So it requires all hands on deck in a lot of different areas to maintain our infrastructure. We do know that when it disappears on us, when you don't have clean drinking water, when your transportation networks are shut down, or when you don't have energy, as we've seen in various places around the country where things have happened, we really appreciate infrastructure at that time. And what we want to make sure is that we don't have to do that on the back end, that we're proactive and not reactive.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate your time and your efforts. Tom Smith, Executive Director, American Society of Civil Engineers. We'll talk to Dane Cialino when we come back about the murder of that North Shore police officer. 923, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 929, things happen in life. You have a split second to make a decision. And as a result of a decision that Adrian Wattall, 17 years old, made, and I'll say allegedly because he's just charged with it, Sergeant Grant Candy, St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Officer, is dead. He leaves behind a wife and two children. And the driver of the vehicle, as well as two other 17-year-olds, have been charged with first-degree murder as a result of the death of this police officer. Dane Cialino, our friend, professor of law at Loyola, joins us now to talk about all of this. How you doing, Dane?
That's fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm well, sir. You know, I said this, and it does all come down sometimes to one decision, huh? The police light you up and pull you over, and you got one decision to decide whether you're going to stop or not. And from there, events happen, and events and decisions have consequences. And these three 17-year-olds are certainly facing the consequences. Tell me what constitutes first-degree murder and the likelihood of conviction in this case, or at least as far as the legalities of it are concerned.
Well, a charge against the driver certainly makes perfect sense. The driver certainly knew that he was being pursued by the police, and likely when he saw the roadblock at the Oak Harbor exit for I-10 from I-10 in Slidell, he kept on going and ran over an officer. If the state contends that he had the specific intent to kill the officer, then that's enough to be first-degree murder, because you couple that specific intent with an aggravating circumstance that the victim, the intended victim, was a police officer. Mm-hmm. That's a classic case of first-degree murder in Louisiana. Now, I see that the sheriff's office has booked some of the passengers in the car with first-degree murder as well. And those charges are going to be much, much more difficult to prove because simply riding along with someone who has the intent to kill doesn't make you an accomplice to first-degree murder unless you also share the intent to kill and do something to aid or and abet the killing, which is possible. I mean, it could be that somebody in the car was egging on the driver, like hit him, mm-hmm. Or something like that. But absent evidence like that, I don't think they're going to be able to sustain any first-degree murder charges against the passenger. But as I said, the driver, that's a much easier case.
And this could be an attempt to try to get testimony from the other two passengers. Well, there are two passengers charged. There were additional two passengers as well. Five people in a vehicle is total. How do you see this playing out, Dane?
Well, I don't think you kill a deputy in St. Tammany Parish and face anything less than a first-degree murder mm-hmm. charge. Now, of course, first-degree murder carries the possible death penalty. Whether they pursued death against the driver or not remains to be seen. But I certainly expect the grand jury to indict the driver for first-degree murder. As to the other passengers, I think it depends on how the evidence pans out about what they were doing in the car, what role they might have played in trying to aid or abet the killing of the police officer. But I wouldn't be surprised to see first-degree murder against the driver and perhaps even a decision to seek the death penalty.
17 years old has nothing to do with this at all, correct?
Well, I mean, he certainly can be charged as an adult for the first-degree murder. It may be that there's a constitutional problem with seeking the death penalty against someone because they were 17 at the time of the perpetration of the offense. But you can bet that the St. Tammany's DA's office is going to push this as to make it the most onerous charge they can possibly make it.
And absent death penalty, what's the punishment for first degree murder?
Mandatory life in jail without the benefit of probation, parole, or suspension of sentence.
So it would be hard to believe, and again, nobody knows. We're speculating here. I would doubt that this would be something that anybody would want to plead out if you're the DA?
From
the driver's standpoint, at least?
Yeah, from the driver's standpoint, the only possibility would be some sort of manslaughter plea to get him a term of years, 40 years or something along those lines. But again, given that a deputy was killed, I don't expect the DA's office to offer any mercy or quarter at all to the driver.
The only plea I could see would be take the death penalty off the table for a plea of guilty to first-degree murder, you think?
Or second-degree murder. Doesn't really make much difference. It's life is life, no matter whether it's for first-degree murder or second-degree murder.
Either way, it would be hard to believe, at least for me, that this 17-year-old, the driver at least, will not spend the rest of his life in jail.
I think that's highly likely at this point, yes.
Anything else, Dane, I'm missing you, my head?
No, sad case. Bad case, bad yeah. decisions, just like you said.
Yeah. It really is. It's amazing. You got to be careful about who your kids hang out with as well. Thank you, sir. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, and it is so senseless is what the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office says, and it's true. That's what Sheriff Randy Smith said. You got a 37-year-old deputy, Grand Candies, leaves behind a wife and two kids, and they have a GoFundMe page set up. You can find it at our website at WWL.com if you click on the story. Five youths, I guess I'll use a word, in the car. Three 17-year-olds arrested, charged with first-degree murder. I don't see there's any way, as Dane was just saying, that the driver of this vehicle doesn't go to jail for the rest of his life at a minimum. And I'm not saying that shouldn't happen. It just goes to show you that, man, you got a split second to make a decision. If you make the wrong one, it can go south very quickly for everybody. Quick break. We come back. We'll talk about the security breach that happened on Signal, this app, and how attack plans were accidentally texted to a reporter. We'll talk about that when we come back, 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. eyebrow-raising security breach that happened with attack plans on the Houthi rebels. Javed Ali joins us, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration and an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. Good morning, sir. How are you? Do you have me on mute, perhaps? Professor?
I do not. Do you hear me?
I can hear you now. Fine. Thank you, sir. For people that don't know, maybe if you could give me a brief synopsis of what happened with this, the attack plans being sent to a reporter.
So, Tommy, yeah, this is still an evolving story, but based on what is just most recently coming out, it appears that in the aftermath of must have been a weeks-long deliberate planning process led by the National Security Council in the White House to consider what should the United States do against the threat from these Houthi rebels in Yemen, that at some point, sort of as a sidebar, I guess that's the best way I could describe it, this chat group was created by the National Security Advisor, Michael Waltz, or people around him, on the phones of all the senior folks who were involved in those National Security Council meetings inside the White House. And then it appears that there were these parallel conversations about issues related to, you know, what was being discussed in this highly classified forum inside the National Security Council. Then some of those discussions moved into the signal chat on individuals' personal cell phones. So that's where things, to me, seem to have deviated or drifted from the formal planning process that was led by the White House, because the name of the group suggests that, because Michael Waltz or whoever created the group labeled it the Yemen PC, which stands for Principals Committee Small Group. So that right there tells me that there were a series of these meetings inside the White House that went all the way up to the Principals Committee, which Waltz would chair as a National Security Advisor, and then all the folks who were in that chat group were probably at the table in those White House meetings.
So this Atlantic reporter, and what bothers me, because everything's political, right, is that Hegseth first denied it, even though the White House said, yes, it does look legitimate. They attacked the reporter, whom, if anything, I think the reporter is to be commended, because he sat on this. He didn't publish it because he knew it was of national security concern. The president himself attacked Atlantic magazine and said he didn't like it, that they were in trouble and the business was likely to fail. When in essence, this was a huge blunder that outlined an attack that could have put people in jeopardy. Is that accurate, Professor?
So another one of these really puzzling aspects of the series of events, and we've already talked about one, sort of this deviation from like the standard planning process that is tightly controlled and highly classified within the White House, and migrating over some of those discussions, migrating over into this signal chat group. How in the world did somebody add a reporter to that chat group and nobody else in the group knew that that reporter was in there? I mean, that
was my question, professors. What in the hell? Why in the hell? Where? In what universe? What button do you press? How do you mistakenly put a reporter in attack plans for the U.S. military? I don't...
Yeah, I mean, again, that's why I keep using the word puzzling. I don't understand how, even if they wanted to keep this signal group going, which they shouldn't have, but they did on their personal cell phones, then adding a reporter, and was that just a mistake, or was Goldberg, or were some of these folks previously a source for Goldberg, and that's why they added him? Like, I can't explain it other than just, you know, trying to grasp it. At some of these explanations, but then Goldberg sat in it in the chat group. No one knew that he was there, or sort of raised questions. Who is this person with the initials JG? Mm-hmm. And then he claims to have sort of seen these very sensitive operational details about the strikes that then happened on March 15th against the Houthis, and then there were follow-on strikes for the next couple of days. But at the flip side, on the flip side, Secretary of Defense Hegseth has denied that there were those details were in the chat group. I think the White House press secretary has also come out and said that there was no classified information. So now we've got a question of two sides telling two very different stories. And from the public side, I don't think we know all the facts or know where the truth is at this moment.
So this reporter would have had to have made this up if those are not accurate screenshots, right?
Well, again, I would have a hard time believing Jeffrey Goldberg would invent something that sort of striking in its revelation, because the other screenshots that he shared show some of the folks in this chat group and the reactions to the strikes and the aftermath of them occurring, and then some of the other discussions about sort of the policy dimensions of what would potentially happen. But we don't know yet if Goldberg will share what he saw or whether he managed to also take screenshots or capture that information. But both the Secretary of Defense and the White House are pushing back on that. So, again, it's not clear where the truth lies, but I would have a hard time believing Goldberg would just make it up. Because, again, if he was making it up, then that would just do grave damage to the credibility of him as a journalist and to The Atlantic as an organization.
Why would they even be using Signal in the first place? And tell me about that app. I know it's encrypted, but, well, first of all, it could be as encrypted as you want. If you send it to the wrong person, then the cat is out of the bag. But what would be the proper way to do it? Tell me about Signal, and would this be some kind of way to keep it private and get around a public records request or something? I'm trying to understand the thought process behind all of this.
Right. So whether it's Signal or WhatsApp or other secure messaging applications that you can download for free onto your phone or your computer, they provide end-to-end encryption of the content of the communication. But again, if you created a group versus sort of a point-to-point conversation or discussion, well, now you potentially have increased the risk of other people knowing about your encrypted communications, and then the devices themselves could be compromised too. And with all these very senior U.S. government folks who are in the group, who knows? Like Russia, China, other adversaries of the United States. Have they been trying to gain some kind of electronic access to their personal cell phones? I don't know the answer to that. But again, like that's something you would have to consider from a risk perspective. But the fact that this Signal group was created and then the conversations within the group, even if everyone thought they were encrypted and secure to people who were invited in it, were happening on their personal cell phones, that again is another issue, because even if they wanted to have these parallel conversations outside of the realm of the White House, when they were having them physically inside the Situation Room, why wouldn't they have used their government-issued cell phones to have the same kind of group chat? Which maybe they could have done that, maybe they couldn't have, but it seems like they were going for sort of expediency by having these conversations on Signal on their personal cell phone.
I know you.
If there's no classified communication, then it still seems like a breakdown in protocol.
I know you have to go. Politics aside, what do you want to see done? How do they fix this? Just make sure nothing like that ever happens again?
Yeah, well, hopefully there's some pretty clear guidance from the White House now coming out about these kind of conversations cannot happen on your personal cell phone anymore. If you're going to have them, they have to be inside a government facility, which the Situation Room is, and that's why you have the National Security Council meetings there, or you have to have them on your government-issued phones, but you can't do it on your personal phone, even if you're trying to use Signal or WhatsApp. And we'll see if that happens. Right now, also, President Trump has said, he's not intent on removing or firing Mike Waltz. So doesn't look like anyone is going to lose their job over this right now either.
Thank you, Professor. I know you got to go. Appreciate your time. Javed Ali, former Senior Director for Counterterrorism National Security Council during the first Trump administration, an Associate Professor of Practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. The hardest thing in the world for some people to say is, oh, we goofed that up. We made a mistake. And as opposed to, you know, political sacrifices or this one getting fired or that, the other thing, I would just hope that, you know, forget Hillary Clinton, forget this, forget that. Let's move forward and just make sure that this never happens again and make sure that the proper protocols are being fired because you would think that, man, when it comes to something like this, it's done in a room with lead walls where nobody can hear what's going on or see what's going on, or some kind of satellite phone that's encrypted or something. This freaked me out when I heard about this yesterday. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.